keep KPFT strong and free for everyone. You can help. This fall, KPFT is holding its fall fun drive. Let's kick it off with a bang. Pledge now at kpft.org. And thanks from all of us all over the country who listen to KPFT.
You are listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT, Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Welcome to Technology Bites. Why are the headphones turned all the way down? Okay, there we go.
I can hear you.
All right, I am this distance from my microphone. Set levels accordingly. I will now move in closer.
Stop it.
Now I'll move back.
Do it right.
All
right,
welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's...
Groovehouse.
What?
Groovehouse.
What?
Is it going to be the, is it again?
Look, see, I said it equal.
Yeah, we're good.
And you're very quiet.
But the mic is, okay,
you're very, very quiet.
Groovehouse.
Near?
There we go.
Our one listener was complaining and he mentioned Groovehouse by name.
Speak into the lamp, Groovehouse.
Apparently he's sweet on you. All right, welcome
people
to the show.
People want more Groovehouse.
So do we don't have Pete, but so far we don't have Isn't as well.
Isn't. It's the greatest thing ever.
In the history of this show.
In the history of all time.
We're glad you could tune in. We're glad you're here. It's the week before the fundraiser, so you've got that to look forward to.
And we're right at a month out from our 20th, aren't we?
Yes, we have decided that we're going to have a party.
Woohoo!
So we have information up at geekradio.com if you want to go to the website
party.
And learn how to
party.
How to party with the geeks. We're going to have our 20th anniversary show.
Wow. 20th. 1995.
I know.
Dial-up, Windows 95.
Windows 95. Wow.
Windows 95, for those privileged few, there were still plenty of people who said, what's wrong with Windows 3.1
plenty.
Or 1.1?
Plenty.
3.10, yeah.
Hey, 3.1.1 introduced networking. Come on. What do I need plug and play for? I don't have a CD-ROM. Oh, I got to have a CD-ROM.
Yeah.
There were still people on DOS at that point.
There was a floppy version.
Slightly hobbyist, but people on DOS.
There was.
There was a floppy disk version. It used what do they call it, proprietary... I think it was like MFD formatted floppy. The first disk was regular formatted, so you could use it. And then every other disk was high-density MFD, whatever they call it, so that it could be like 15 floppy disks instead of 300,000 floppy disks.
I don't think it was 300,000.
No, maybe like 200,000. Yes, probably realistically more like 26.
It's journalist math. It's fine.
2,600 disks?
Pete.
26,000.
So, yeah, I would, upgrading to Windows 95 or installing Windows 95.
I remember that. It was
certainly challenging. Yeah. I mean, I remember it was very exciting when it came out. I mean, it certainly looked
it's brand new. Nothing has really changed since
it
then,
looked
arguably.
New. It,
yeah.
I mean, it took
radical departure from 3.11.
To keep you in your comfort zone, it took all of your program manager groups and put them in the start menu for you, just in case if you were doing an upgrade.
I did clean install. Brand new hard drive, brand new OS.
Didn't want to take your progman groups with you?
There's no reason for 3.11 to keep living on. Although I think I still have a box somewhere that boots 3.11.
Well, as long as you could get to a command prompt.
Yeah.
With XP, I forget. Could you shell out of Windows completely?
Yeah.
You could.
In XP?
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry, in Windows 95.
In 95,
yeah, yes.
You could shell out of 95 and go straight to a command line.
You could, I think, up until 98, possibly 98 SE.
They introduced the fake command line, the fake CMDXE, but the old command was around for a while, which was nice.
You could bust out in real mode.
Because really, it was launching DOS, and it would launch Windows, especially in the 3.10 and 3.11.
Well, then the 3.10, 3.11, or the 3.1, 3.11, it would load DOS, and then it would load Windows.
Well, one of my readers, when I did, because of course I did a Windows 95 retrospective, because pretty much everybody did. One of my readers
pointed
out.
You're that old? Or just recently?
Just recently.
20 years. Okay.
Just recently for the 20th.
Should be dedicating your time to a Technology Bytes retrospective.
One of the readers pointed out something about how, like, even though you could exit out into DOS, Windows 95 wasn't just a shell. And he had actually a really detailed comment that involved talking about how, like, you didn't have to thunk down into real mode and thunk this and thunk that. Made me think he was actually kind of some kind of programming developer kind of guy because he used fancy words. But it was more than just a shell. Although, yes, you could bust out into DOS and deal with MSCDEX and load high and...
Well, you could.
Those,
yeah, I mean, you could boot it.
You could
boot it with a config sys and autoexec that, or you didn't have to.
Did you have to do at Technology Bytes in the grand old days autoexec bat and config sys file troubleshooting for people? Do they call in and talk about how, like,
sure
they need more low memory and, like, how do I load high my mouse driver?
I think that there was some talk about QEMM.
Absolutely, everybody loved QEMM.
Memory managers and the glories of upgrading to maybe 8 megs of RAM.
Which would have been, what, a $200-$300 upgrade? Something
easily.
Ridiculous?
Yeah, you could spend a lot on not very much RAM back in the day.
Well, it seemed like a lot back then.
So, anyway, you can visit us online at geekradio.com. We do have information up there about the upcoming anniversary.
What's the actual date? What's the save the date?
It's October the 17th, so we will be skipping... Okay. We will be skipping. Is it October the 17th?
I think 17th, I believe.
We're
going to
skip the Geek Gathering.
October 17th is a Saturday.
Yes, and we're going to, we have kind of penciled in, we're going to meet at Cones. We don't know if we're going to do the roof or not. The plan is to do the roof, weather permitting and all that. But we got the invites out on Facebook. We've got the information up on the website.
There's links to buy the cool shirts.
Tell them about the shirts, Jay.
Well, I heard, Pete, rumor that we're offering those shirts as premiums during the fundraiser.
Also, yes. That would be true.
Ah.
All right.
That's
so,
kind of cool.
Unless they come back and say we can't.
They just told me that they could and that they would. I guess you've invited a lot of work on yourself, it sounds like. Do we know what we're offering them at the premium? At the...
$1 million.
That's something we'll have to decide.
$1 billion.
So anyway, fundraiser next week, but this week regular show, and we're also on IRC, irc.cuckoo.com. If you want to hang out with us in the IRC, You can do that.
In the IRC.
In the IRC. Yeah, the channel is Tech Bytes.
IRC chat.
IRC chat. Use your ATM machine.
I just say ATM.
You want to make sure and use the internet IRC chat.
The internet relay IRC chat.
From the Department of Redundancy Department.
I don't have a NIC card. I can't join the IRC chat.
Such problems.
Yes. So, reminisce in 20 years. Yippee. All right. So, that's us in, that's it. All right. We got Pete. We don't have the loop feedback Pete version. So.
It isn't.
All right.
I can.
You can't. You're not allowed. Of course, tell
I'm pretty
him
sure
he's
I
not
can.
Allowed. I'll pretty much make sure he'll do it.
Don't.
Please don't throw me in the briar patch. All right. Let's go to San Antonio since we have the live hookup with San Antonio and do the Technology Bytes info shot. Take it away, info shot.
Not yet.
No?
Pizza's because no.
So close to the perfect show.
Isn't.
Dun, 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 dun.
Okay.
Click, click, click.
This time for sure.
Take it away, InfoShot.
It's the Technology Bytes InfoShot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
All right, our first story is one that hits close to home, well, relatively close, and is just so insanely stupid. Although it's apparently gotten fixed mostly by now. A student in Irving, Texas, up in Dallas, wanted to show his teachers about his ingenuity, and so he had a clock that he made, a digital clock that he made at home that he made himself, and he brought it in to show his science teacher. And some other teacher saw him with it. I should probably mention, it's kind of critical to the story. The kid's name is Ahmed Mohammed. So what do you think happened when somebody saw him with a circuit board, a digital readout, and some wires in his backpack? Yeah, they thought that he was there to go all terrorist on them. They called the police, who arrested the kid because he would only tell them that it was a clock. They were upset. They thought it was a bomb. And they were upset that he didn't tell them more about how it was a clock after he kept telling them that it was a clock. So on the plus side, this time people sort of stepped up, and the police have dropped the charges, although they hauled the kid off. They cuffed him, and they took him in to the station kind of thing. So a smart kid who did a project at home and brought it to school, that scared everybody crazy, and they had him arrested and so on. Ahmed told the reporters it was, quote, very sad that his teacher thought his clock was a threat. He said, quote, I built a clock to impress my teacher. When I showed it to her, she thought it was a threat to her. I'm very sad that she got the wrong impression of it, unquote. At the same news conference on Wednesday afternoon, he announced he plans to transfer schools. Probably wise. Although, you know, maybe he needs to carry around that clock. He can, like, hide it in people's lockers. Just kidding. I don't want him to be in any more trouble. The police claimed that he brought a, quote, hoax bomb to school. And there is a photo. If you go to geekradio.com, we have links to all the articles, as always. Plus, we have links to stuff about the, you know, anniversary geek gathering. And if you can't, you know, if you want to order a shirt directly, you can do that, or you can wait till the pledge drive, or you can give ahead. And once we figure out the pledge levels for the shirts, we can hook you up. Anyways, a big cred to the president who tweeted after this came up. He tweeted, cool clock, Ahmed. Want to bring it to the White House? We should inspire more kids like you to like science. It's what makes America great. Unquote. Now, of course, certain media can't resist mischaracterizing things. So on CNN, and I kid you not, On CNN, the headline for the article that said that, you know, Obama tweeted the invitation to the White House said that – said Obama invites kid who – or, you know, invites student who built bomb to White House, which that's just extra clever. But apparently, you know, hopefully he's going to go to a school that's more science-oriented and less, I don't know, Dallas crazy terrorist fearing oriented. But you know, this is where technology bites hardest, I guess. You know, I think it's pretty good that a kid his age could wire up something interesting like that and wanted to share it. But you know, then we're all crazy down here. We're all crazy in Houston about this kind of stuff. Although in the not so pleasant side of things, you know, there's always a hackery story every week now. You can't miss anymore. There's an attack we talked about it a little bit, I think, a few weeks ago. There's some attacks that are hitting Cisco Systems routers. And the thing that was interesting is at first it was thought to be kind of small and focused, but apparently it's a lot more active than previously reported. Infections have hit at least 79 devices in 19 countries, including an ISP in the U.S. that's hosting 25 boxes running the malicious backdoor. The discovery comes from a team of computer scientists who probed the entire IPv4 address space looking for infected devices. Ours reported, I got this from Ars Technica, they reported on Tuesday the, quote, so-called sinful NOC router implant. A sinful NOC router implant is activated after receiving an unusual series of non-compliant network packets followed by a hard-coded password. By sending only the out-of-sequence TCP packets but not the password to every internet address and then monitoring the response, the researchers were able to detect which ones were infected by the backdoor. I guess it's sort of, you almost, you know, it's almost too bad that they're saying that they figured out how to find where all of these were, because it seems like you could kind of, you know, you could maybe watch and see who's coming in and what they're doing. But security firm FireEye surprised the security world on Tuesday when it first reported the active outbreak of Sinful NOC, SYN, for those of you SYNAC folks. The implant is precisely the same size as the legitimate Cisco router image, and it's loaded each time the router is restarted. Isn't that nice? It supports up to 100 modules that attackers can tailor to the specific target. FireEye found it on 14 servers in India, Mexico, the Philippines, and Ukraine. The finding was significant because it showed an attack that has long been theorized was in fact actively being used. The new research shows it is being used much more widely, and it's been found in countries including the U.S., Canada, the U.K., Germany, and China. So apparently it's fingerprintable, and you know, so they scanned for it. Let's see. What is clear now is that Sinful NOC is a professionally developed and fully featured backdoor device that almost certainly is actively infecting many more devices than previously seen by FireEye. It's plausible some of the devices the scientists witnessed were honeypots, like, you know, routers intentionally infected by white hat researchers who are looking for clues about who's behind the attacks and how they operate. Still, it seems unlikely that all 79 are decoys. So we'll see what happens. Just in case you're feeling all smug because you don't have a Cisco device, it's not even specifically about Cisco. It's not exploiting a vulnerability in a Cisco device. Apparently, the attackers behind the implant are taking advantage of routers that use passwords that are factory default or are somehow otherwise known. The researchers said it wouldn't be surprising if networking gear from other manufacturers are being infected with a similar backdoor. So far, there's no evidence of infections hitting devices from other manufacturers. But with additional internet scans, researchers may find data proving that theory correct. So yet another thing to make sure that you've secured. If you're running a Cisco router, you're at that level and you're running a Cisco router, have a decent password. You should be getting paid pretty well. But anyways, apparently 79 different people around the world aren't getting paid that well, or they aren't that good at their job. And in other irritating news, well, actually, I think this one, so far the good guys seem to be doing well. And some internet service providers sued the FCC about net neutrality rules, claiming that it violated their First Amendment rights somehow if they had to go ahead and pass all data through their systems equally. The FCC yesterday said it did not violate the First Amendment rights of internet service providers. There's a filing with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. See if this makes sense to you. You can listen and decide if the FCC's argument holds water. They say ISPs are conduits for the speech of others. They are not delivering their own messages when they connect their customers to the internet, the FCC argued. Rules against blocking and throttling internet content thus do not violate the ISP's constitutional rights. Quote, nobody understands broadband providers to be sending a message or endorsing speech when transmitting the internet content that a user has requested, the FCC wrote. When a user directs her browser to the New York Times or Wall Street Journal editorial page, she has no reason to think that the views expressed there are those of her broadband provider. These objections were raised by AT&T, CenturyLink, CTIA, which is the Wireless Association, and the United States Telecom Association. The argument that net neutrality rules violate broadband providers' First Amendment rights was also made by Verizon. The current case, the First Amendment objections have been made most forcefully by Alamo Broadband, a small provider in Texas. Alamo argued that ISPs, quote, exercise the same editorial discretion as cable television operators in deciding which speech to transmit. So hopefully, I don't know anybody who's a customer of Alamo, but apparently, you know, they're responsible for everything that's transmitted. I think they should be held. If they want to do that, they should be held for anything that one of their customers can view. Think about that one. If they're saying it's the same as deciding what channels to cover, to carry, first off, they should be held liable. But second of all, if you're one of their customers, what sites are they deciding you don't get to see? Just an interesting little question. So so far, we'll keep an eye on this case. If that's the best argument these people are coming up with, I don't think they're going to win, because that's pretty weak, trying to claim that doing your job, you know, transmitting, you know, having, when you have internet, that if they let you go to your browser and go to a website that you want to see, and they don't like try to extort money from them for serving the site to you, that somehow impinges on their First Amendment rights. Unless the First Amendment's been changed where it's about that you have to, you know, guarantee money to greedy ISPs. I don't think that's what it was about. I don't think the Founding Fathers had greedy ISPs back when they wrote the Constitution. Better news, if you have an AT&T, if you're on the unlimited plan, I don't know how many people are left that have stuck it out to keep that. But AT&T has changed their policies regarding its restrictive unlimited data plan customer limits. I still am trying to get my head around the limits that you put on an unlimited data plan. But on the plus side for it, AT&T has raised the pre-throttling limit for their unlimited users to 22 gigabytes. So that's better than it was. The previous limit on your unlimited account, I think there should be quotes. I'm doing air quotes around unlimited from now on in this story. The previous limit on your unlimited account was 5 gigabytes of LTE data. And then, this is even better, 3 gigabytes of 3G data. You know, just in case you aren't keeping track at home, LTE is the like fast one, the one that's kind of where your phone or your tablet is going at speeds that seem very similar to like using Wi-Fi at home. And then 3G is not quite so fast. It's noticeably slower. But it's so precious. The 3G data is so precious that you only get 3 gigs of that before they – or you only used to get 3 gigs of that before they limited your unlimited. So they will warn customers if you happen to be using this plan. When you reach 16.5 gigs of usage, effectively 75% of the limit, AT&T will warn you. So if you're on that program, you'll know that you're getting onto the wrong track or whatever. A couple other quickie stories. Here, this one was sort of interesting. I hadn't, you know, I mean, obviously you know the code base for Google is pretty big. But now there's apparently they at an engineering conference in Silicon Valley, Google's Rachel Potvin, I think that's how you pronounce your last name, was asked about the software that runs Google's internet services. From Google Search to Gmail to Google Maps, she said that it spans some 2 billion lines of code to run Google. By just comparison, Microsoft Windows, one of the most complex software tools ever built for a single computer, and that they've been working on, you know, think about it. We talked about it. You know, Windows 95 it's been, you know, a lot of years. It's been 20 years for Windows 95, and they were working on Windows stuff earlier than that. They were working on that in the 80s. That is likely in the realm of 50 million lines of code. So Google is roughly the equivalent of building the Windows operating system 40 times over. And the other interesting part is, you know, Windows is basically lots of pieces of code that do particular tasks, you know, little specific things. So there's all the different little, you know, all the different functions on a small scale. The Google stuff is that they drive sort of one big thing. They drive Google Search, Google Maps, Google Docs, Google Plus, that kind of stuff. And the other interesting thing is all 2 billion lines of code sit in a single code repository available to all 25,000 Google engineers. Within the company, Google treats its code like an enormous operating system. Quote, though I can't prove it, unquote, Potvin says, I would guess that this is the largest single repository in use anywhere in the world. I would guess. Of course, just maintaining that is apparently a large chore. Building and running a 2 billion line monolith is no simple task. The numbers are, you know, kind of staggering. You know, GitHub lets lots of people share and collaborate on code, but that's not like one software project. Google goes even a step further. They combine many projects into one, which sounds sort of crazy, but apparently it works. They have their own version control system for juggling all this code. The system is called Piper, and it runs across the vast online infrastructure Google has built to run all of its online services and spans 10 different Google data centers. You can read more about it, but that's pretty impressive. The numbers just get crazy, you know, for especially anybody who's run a project or worked on a project of any size. The numbers for Google are just staggering. Google engineers modify 15 million lines of code across 250,000 files every week. So I just thought that was an interesting piece of information. And they talk, oh, just for comparison, how big is Facebook? About 20 million lines of code. Only about 20 million lines of code. And finally, this one we've talked about sort of prepping before, and people have mentioned the various hosts have mentioned the like EMP problem, you know, how do you prep for an EMP with all your technology? Or the other big one, massive solar storm. Gizmodo had an article about the preppers who are ready for the next massive solar storm. A massive solar storm strikes only about once every 500 years, but if the Earth was hit by one, power grids across the world could be permanently fried. How would we survive the space storms? To find out, this writer from Gizmodo spoke with individuals already prepping for the technopocalypse and engineers who are hoping to fortify our infrastructure against it. The big thing is, of course, they do the usual prepper thing where they have years of food and all that kind of normal stuff. But the big thing, if you're going to try and protect yourself from space weather, is you want to, you know, well, and here's the thing. This is what happens. The deal is with the solar storm, there's huge amounts of current of electricity that get up in the air and it goes to ground. And so that's what, and so that can really screw up, obviously can really screw up systems when you inject massive amounts of power into them that they're not built to handle or they're not expected to handle. But if you want to be absolutely sure that your data and electronics remain safe, what would you do? You build a Faraday cage, which sounds, you know, and on movies they make them look kind of cooler. But, you know, the easiest way to build a simple Faraday cage, quote, most people just use a metal trash can, unquote, a design engineer told Gizmodo. I use vintage metal picnic baskets and numerous metal cookie-type tins. So you can build your own Faraday cage, or if you, you know, at least you could run, and if you have a metal trash can, you can, maybe that'll help you, like, save your stuff if you ever hear that the big storm is coming. There are other more ambitious designs. A 40-foot-tall Faraday cage built from a cargo container. Inside the leaky doors, there will be a wall of steel with the only access being bolted on plates of steel using copper or brass mesh as the fabric between the entry plate and the steel wall. Inside, put wood shelving and put smaller metal Faraday cage boxes that can hold computers, radios, water pumps, and vehicle ignitions that may be destroyed by a solar storm or by an EMP attack. The thing is, this is an ambitious design, but it's not... no one's built one yet. No, but that one has not been built. Of course, it's one thing to start with a garbage can, but the next question, what to put in it that might be of any use once the event happens? If there's no commercial power and most other electronic devices are destroyed, how good is your iPhone that you put in a Faraday cage going to be? A lot of it just depends on a lot of people. You know, there's a lot of variables here, and since it hasn't ever happened yet, that makes it more difficult. But most people harken back to the 1859 Carrington event, the largest geomagnetic storm on record. The global telegraph system acted like a giant antenna. Telegraph stations across the world caught fire, technicians were electrocuted, and widespread communication outages ensued. If a Carrington-like storm were to strike Earth today.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
The storm got Pete.
And his parrot.
Did we lose Pete? I guess the electrical storm hit right at the end of that.
That sounded like it was fun. I mean, telegraph wires caught on fire. There was mass havoc. There were some pictures of it out there, mostly artist renditions of it.
Dogs and cats
living together.
mass hysteria.
Raw references. All right. Well, we'll see what happened to Pete, but I think we got most of it. We got the gist.
Did we get the gist? And that's the news. Probably.
All right.
What's the story with Pete? Did he, in fact, get zapped by the.
Is y'all's internet connection working?
I don't think so.
I don't know. Yes?
I'm still pinging.
Yeah, I'm downloading a ton of movies. It's working just fine.
Are you streaming the show live as you listen to it?
Yes, it's a loop.
I still have the internet.
I have all the internets over here. My internet is 5x5.
Yes.
Ghost Rider.
It's a small internet, man. You should get a bigger screen.
No.
That looked like a 13-inch.
We're using Top back Gun in the day reference. Internet.
They don't do that anymore, apparently. No more Top Gun. It's Drone Gun. Top Drone. Top Drone. Disappointing.
Yeah, I don't think it's a thing anymore.
No, the new Top Gun movie is going to be all about drones.
Is Maverick going to be in it?
I think he is. He's going to be maybe a drone instructor. I don't really understand.
Is Tom Skerritt going to be in it?
No.
Is he still alive?
I don't know.
It's about drones, but he's going to have to get in a real plane and go shoot them down.
Shoot a drone down.
Oh,
wasn't that
a Clint
Eastwood movie called Firefox? That was Firefox. Clint Eastwood did that movie already. And if Clint Eastwood didn't do it, then Chevy Chase did it with Deal of the Century.
Now, when does The Martian... Oh, and Pete's back. I was going to ask about The Martian.
Are you going to ask Pete about The Martian?
I want to ask Pete about the parrot.
Yeah,
what's up with the bird?
What's going on, Pete?
What parrot?
The one that makes...
Is that what it sounded like?
That's what it sounded
like. He isn't parrot?
That parrot.
Or is that somebody
screaming?
I think
that's Chillin's.
That's one of my kids.
Just one. Come on.
I think they're watching video. They're watching playthroughs of
in the
video
room
games,
there with you.
I think downstairs.
Well, it was very funny because you're talking about the summer storm coming in the EMP.
I don't know. I think I caught it when it cut off.
Well, it was kind of. I thought it was kind of planned because you kind of cut off right after you talked about the EMP.
Yeah, like, and so, if that big storm were to strike, and that was it, you were gone.
Are you gone again?
I think we lost him again.
I was gone and I'm back. It shows. I've got the window up so I can see it, and it suddenly starts saying connecting. Can you hear me?
Yep, yes. We can hear you.
Okay. Well, when you're quiet on your end,
I know.
So anyways, have you guys prepped at all for, do you have your Faraday cages? I've decided I'm just going to go around and collect metal garbage cans, to be ready for the big solar storm that may not ever happen. Some of the rest of the articles, talks about people who, you know, some of this stuff like would be useful. But if you get really old and the storm hasn't happened, wouldn't you feel like maybe you'd wasted your time? Because one guy says he's created something called the Survivor Library. He's named Rocky Rollins, better known as the Librarian. And it's about having the skills to like make soap and shoes and boots. So the hippies are going to take over if the apparently – or the Foxfire people – if you've ever seen those books. But this guy, basically, he's put together all these digital books, this digital book repository of over 8,000 out-of-print books, and hopes that somebody will keep copies of it in a Faraday cage so the knowledge could be restored. But then the cool part at the end of the article, this is from Gizmodo, like I may have said at the beginning, is that, you know, we could solve this. Re-engineering the power grid to handle it, there is technology out there that could handle this. The biggest thing, there's a guy named, they introduced him earlier in the article and then they just use his last name. His last name is Cap'n Man, who works in the utility industry. He said the real business of prepping for a massive geomagnetic storm needs to happen at the infrastructure level. He says that we need to begin a process of reengineering the power grid to unwind some of its vulnerability. The main thing is that power grids are connected to ground through large, high-voltage transformers, which is normally a good thing for safe operation of the grid, but when geomagnetic storm happens, it becomes a threat. And what he said the solution is, now hopefully more knowledgeable people than us can speak to it, is that what you need to do is install a small device between the transformer connection and its connection to ground. The concept of this device would be a capacitor that will block the DC current from flowing into the power grid during storms and allow the AC current to continue to flow. And it turns out he invented and field tested such a device in the early 1980s, and the industry basically ignored the problem. How much would it cost to harden the grid? If we wanted to do the infrastructure, From what we know right now, this is probably a couple billion dollar fix, according to Kappenman. In the grand scheme of things, it's peanuts. In terms of what it does to electric power costs for the average consumer, it's less than the cost of one postage stamp per year to solve the problem well. But why would we solve it when we can have all kinds of like crazy schemes and prepping and, you know, so that maybe your VW Bug will be your vintage VW Bug will suddenly be the most awesome vehicle around because it still runs because nothing in it was electronical. I don't know. So that's the news.
Thanks for that, Pete.
If that happens, I guess we need to find the kid who knows how to make digital clocks. That'll be his. He'll be valuable again. And I don't know if you guys see that story as it developed today?
Yeah, I watched it a little bit. I mean, to be fair, it kind of did look like a bomb.
But at the same time, it also kind of speaks on, you know, how well school administrators and teachers and police can actually identify, you know, harmless electronics versus an actual bomb. That's a little bit disconcerting. They get so worked up over, you know, a piece of circuit board. You know, for instance, if you were to, you know, take the, you know, break apart, I don't know, anything, or remote control and take it in there, they probably would have freaked out. Just, you know, the sight of bare wires and circuitry.
Well, so did the digital clock, which was, you know, probably some electronic components, did it connect to anything that was larger that looked like it could an explosive?
It was just like a circuit board, some wires, and a small display at the end of the wires.
So what would explode? Nothing. That's something that wasn't connected to any kind of incendiary.
There was no actual thing that looked like an explosive. It was
he
was assembling it a piece at a time. He was bringing the timing device in. Oh,
Well, and it might have helped if he hadn't brought it in when he had his art project, which was four large bricks made out of white Play-Doh that he had in his background. No, I'm kidding. Or else a giant barrel full of diesel fuel and fertilizer.
And when he pulled the elephant's nose, the lamp didn't come on.
Ooh, kind of a deep cut there. Very good.
it's sort of sad. You know, I think the big saddest part of it, at the heart of it all, is that the technology in our schools is apparently so pathetic that a few wires and a digital display is enough to make people think that it's, you know, I don't know, that it's Homeland or what. I'm trying to think of any of the other good terrorist type shows. It's 24. They're looking around for Kiefer Sutherland to come running into the room and save him from a 14-year-old kid who's showing it to the teacher. That's the best part. Because that's what you do if you're a terrorist, right?
No, he was using reverse psychology. He was gonna hide in plain sight. Clearly, that's what was
so clever, as hiding as a skinny kid who knows stuff. Because we know how scary they are.
Clearly, that was what was going on.
But fortunately, we'll have all the preppers will be ready so that we can Faraday preppers. I've just decided I'm going to, like, just maybe if you wrap your house in chain link fence, would that work as a Faraday cage?
I'm not really worried about it. If any of that ever does happen, I don't need to know any of it in advance. I'll just Google it when it happens.
I plan to go in the first wave. I figure that's going to be the, you know, there won't be a rapture, but I figure I'll just be sure and either be one of the first zombies
You're not going to go cannibal apocalypse. You just want to go and just be burned up the first time around. Don't want to have to like deal with the aftermath.
If you really think about it, the odds are that you're not going to be the one that makes it, right? I mean, all these movies, you know, there's how many billion people on a planet, and the movies always start when there's like how many left, you know, 20 or, you know, well, let's just say there's a million left. Well, so what are your odds? It's like winning the lottery or losing. I guess it's like winning the lottery to be still alive in one of these apocalyptic scenarios.
Well, okay, so you want to hear about the absolute most terrifying apocalyptic scenario I've ever seen is there's a BBC television drama. It came out in the mid-1980s. It's called Threads, T-H-R-E-A-D-S, Threads. And it's about Britain during the during and after a nuclear war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And it is absolutely the most horrifying, brutal, awful, terrifying.
Is it worse than The Day After?
It's yes, yes. It is worse than The Day After.
The Day After was like an after-school special.
Yeah, Threads. Threads.
The Day After
is,
was still pretty depressing.
I mean, my parents wouldn't let me watch that one.
No, well, Day After was really strong. Yes, but Threads is the no holds barred crazy British version of it, and it's very tough. If you can get through it in one sitting,
is it worse than Threads in Java?
Yes.
is it a series and how many seasons?
No. It was a one-time deal. It's 112 minutes long. It's just almost a two-hour little TV event. I'm looking at the
a real pick-me-up sort of thing.
All right, well, speaking,
feel good.
Something to make people feel great during the Thatcher years.
Speaking of apocalyptic stories, I've been watching Fear the Walking Dead.
Yes.
How is this related
That's
to the Walking
OC
Dead?
With zombies.
It is no, it's
a little bit.
It's when the outbreak begins.
Yeah.
Oh. Oh. Okay.
So in LA, right?
In LA. Yeah. So it's LA. Set in LA.
So it's very different because you're in a huge city,
right.
You know,
early
huge
on.
City instead of kind of rural.
Right. You're in a huge city where nobody's really sure what's going on, and nobody's figured out that it takes a headshot to kill them, and
that they're all spoiler from The Walking Dead. No one's figured that part out yet.
Well, no, it's. I think it's separate enough to where there aren't a lot of spoilers. Here's my question, though. So most of the zombies movies that come out, like, you know, for instance, let's do Fear of the Walking Dead, it exists in a world that's supposed to be just like our world now, right? So we hit a pause button. This fiction takes place. Does the world they come from not have zombie movies?
That's
they
the
don't.
Thing. That's the thing
they
that
don't.
I question when I watch the latest
No,
episode.
They don't.
It shouldn't
they don't.
Shouldn't the meme they, kick they, in and they kind of catch
they,
on?
They omit,
oh, zombies.
They omit the part of human consciousness that knows what zombies
yeah
are.
No when the guy when Robert Kirk or whatever his name is, the guy that wrote Walking Dead the comic book,
right,
when he originally set out to write it, that was a stipulation, was that this is our world except there's no concept of zombies and zombie movies and all that stuff.
That's
so
kind of
that's
a,
convenient
so that's why they don't call them zombies, right. Because they don't have that word and they don't understand what's going on. And so they call them walkers. They call them, I forgot. They have a bunch of names for them because nobody really knows what to call them because there is no concept of zombies.
It's a pretty common conceit in a lot of fiction. In Star Trek, when they go back to the present day, that's not like they go back and like see Star Trek on TV. It's, you see that in a lot of fiction.
Right.
Well, there's some fan fiction where that happens, I
well,
think.
Well, I'm sure.
And I think, yeah, Kirk gets a crush on himself and some other stuff happens. But yeah, that exists.
Some slash.
Seems legit.
But at any rate, it's an interesting show to watch. I don't know that I like the term. It might be taken, but what I like about it is that you're watching a story where you know that the outcome is not favorable for the general population. Mm-hmm. That if you extrapolate that this is a prequel to the Walking Dead, then you assume that things are in the process of breaking down. So it's interesting to watch how these people are coming to terms with this apocalypse happening.
Well, and that's also, you know, it's one thing to imagine you're in a small town and, you know, the country is like a mile away, you know,
right.
And you can kind of just run out and get to a field and then you're good as long as you can outrun them. You know, if you're in L.A., that's a lot of people turning in a very small space.
Well, that's, I mean,
and
once,
also because it's unfolding and as it is unfolding, there's chaos breaking out. So there's general looting going on, people are misbehaving. So in the middle of this whole, like, you know, looting scene, protests, because what happens is the cops end up having to shoot a homeless guy who's a zombie.
Spoiler alert!
In the head. They have to shoot him in the head to finally drop him. But the people, all they see is, like you would see on the Twitter or Facebook outrage.
Cops shoot homeless guy.
Cops shoot homeless guy. So a protest.
In the head.
Yeah, protest forms up around the scene where the where they've shot this guy, so that people are getting unruly, like, you know, to, you know, F the police and all that's going on. So then when things kind of start deteriorating, a riot breaks out. And in the riot, there's so much chaos that there's actually zombies, like, chomping on people at the same time people are flipping cars over. And
do you think zombies would actually make parts of LA safer?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when the show started, when The Walking Dead started, one of the first things Grimes does after he gets out of the hospital is he gets into whatever the close by city is, Chicago or I forget.
Atlanta.
Okay, I forget. Come on, man. That's how long it's been, man.
CDC, man.
So, and I think the obvious takeaway is after he gets chased through Atlanta by, you know, cloud of zombies, that cities are right out. Like, do not go to cities. They are the zombie death trap, infected hives. Go out away from everybody. So I can't imagine that the Walking Dead, whatever it's called, the Prelude Show,
Fear of the Walking Dead,
I can't imagine it's going to end well for anybody unless they decide at some point to just get the heck out.
Well, that's the way the show's gone right now, is that they have finally realized they need to leave the city, but the people kind of get separated, so they have to wait for them to get back before they can flee, and they're watching their neighbors are kind of turning and stuff, and then finally they're getting to flee, and it might be a little bit of a spoiler, but they start to leave, and that's when the National Guard rolls in. So now you've got the scene where the government's trying to come in and control the scenario.
Is it going to be one of those deals where it's like they might help everybody, or they might just decide that we're going to glass Los Angeles?
Going to cut our losses.
I think it's going to be a deal where they're going to determine that if you're a zombie, you die. If you're not a zombie, you need to go into quarantine.
Ah.
Okay. So what I think it may end up happening, this is speculation now at this point, but my guess is that people start to get rounded up. Ah. And so you're going to be stuck in an internment camp.
Until somebody in the internment camp dies.
But we know from watching The Walking Dead that's not going to go well for the people in the internment camp. They may be second after the people guarding the internment camp, but they still got their time to come. But it's an interesting thing to watch where you know the general outcome of the whole story is not good. I think in an apocalyptic scenario in this country that I assume things are not going to go well. They're just not going to. I mean, people prepping and whatever. Sure, if you've got a bunker somewhere and you've got food laid in, then and you've got enough weapons to defend it for a while, people will come for it. People will start. You know, the opportunists will.
Well, yeah, that's
the people that have not prepped. They're going to prey on the preppers.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm thinking like, oh, the best thing you can do is if you could find a tall building that had a restaurant at the top of it, because there's a lot of food and it's away from the zombies, right? But the problem is there's going to be a lot of other people thinking that, and then you're going to have to like fight with live humans over who's going to get the food and who's going to stay up there.
See, that's why at my house we're not hoarding food. We're just hoarding ammunition.
Right. You're just paying attention to the neighbors.
But you know that there's probably the Uber preppers who they're not laying in a stockpile of anything. They're just watching American Preppers and making notes of who's
right. That's what I mean.
Well, that's why it's such a big deal to like not let people know where you're building your hideouts, your bunkers, or whatever. You know, you don't want
to be standing out there exercising your open carry, right? Standing in front of your bunker going, yeah, I'm ready.
the other realistic part to this, though, is, you know, the zombie thing, obviously, that reality doesn't support the concept of zombies in our particular reality. But just if you just take sort of a large scale disaster, you take something, you know, global wide that interrupts, you know, like the solar storm thing that interrupts power and all that. The realistic sequence of events is, even if there's not like the kind of, you know, mass, you know, fighting chaos, is for the first couple weeks, what happens? Everybody hunkers down at home and they eat the food they have on hand or that they can get from a supermarket. You know, the billions of people around the world, they're going to – and so they'll consume that. And it's when that's gone that things get really gritty, especially when you're talking about where you can't, like, plant more food or grow more stuff. It's going to get eaten up by the billions who then will die, like, 3 weeks later, but they ate all the food.
Well,
and what have you got left?
It's scary to think because, you know, after what was the hurricane that actually hit us? Ike. Right. I remember after Ike, you know, there was no gas to be had. There was no power in most places. And it was, you know, this was a scenario. It's like, this is a completely recoverable scenario. We're going to get through this. 8 days without power. Everything will be back to normal in a couple of weeks. It's not a big, it wasn't like a Katrina or something.
I had to wait like 3 or 4 days for a hot meal.
But what I noticed was when, you know, when I went, when I did go out, I needed to get some gas, so I went out looking for some gas, and
kill a man.
He ran over a couple people who were trying to stop him.
Well, I got to a gas station that actually had gas and had a working pump, and somebody, a group of guys, had staked out the pump and were basically like taking a toll. You had to pay them to pay the gas station to get your gas.
This really? Was it their station?
This was over on the 610 loop, I think. Is there on 610 loop or on the Beltway? It was not their place, but they were a threatening look group of guys, and they just kind of basically had staked out the one functioning pump, and people were coming up, and they were like, "If you want to go, you know, I don't know." It was very weird.
Did you beat them up, Jay?
It was.
Did you
very,
pay? Did you pay the
no,
tax?
No, I didn't get any gas. I just moved on. It was very weird.
Shady.
There was a predatory thing going on. It, once things kind of broke down just a little bit, there was this kind of, you know, territorial weirdness going on. So I can only imagine that if, you know, we lose power, you're not getting electricity for months or maybe years or ever. If something like that happened, then that the whole scenario, I think, just gets really, I mean, no matter how much you prep or... I don't think I'm a survivor. I don't think I'm someone who's going to live through it.
No, and it's a house of cards, too, because
you'd have to be lucky.
Once it only takes one bad element to extinguish trust, and everybody's all happy and cooperating until one guy decides to start looking for, you know, charging people for the gas pump or whatever. Right. And then everybody starts to get more cautious, and then everything breaks down. It's just like, I mean, it just takes the one thing to start the dominoes falling before we're in Mad Max with Morton Joe and all these guys riding around.
One of the things in the scenario, and we're going to have to take a break here shortly, but one of the things in the Fear of the Walking Dead that's interesting is, like, how do you know it's time to leave? Like, I mean, people are watching it kind of unfold, and it's like, you know, I could see a scenario where things were starting to break down, but you're thinking it's going to be okay, and I'm not going to leave it. I'm going to shortchange myself on time. It's like, as opposed to like fleeing as soon as the lights.
Yeah, ask,
I'm getting out of here right now. Just in case.
Ask Colonel Fannin about that.
All right. Well, that music tells us we got to take a short break, so we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barry.
I'm Lee.
And he's
Rufus.
All right. We'll be right back.
You can find KPFT on the social networking sites Twitter and Facebook? You certainly can, and we'd love you to add us as a friend and get us connected with friends of yours. Join our fan page and check out a special video message from General Manager Dwayne Bradley, as well as keep up with KPFT programmers and staff. Visit facebook.com/KPFT Houston to join us. To follow us, visit twitter.com/KPFT. With both, you can link up with other KPFT listeners, get the latest news about the station, and find lots of extras. It's fun, so catch up with KPFT online. Again, on Twitter, visit twitter.com/KPFT. On Facebook, visit us at facebook.com/KPFT Houston. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
The organization Woman's Roots will be having a fundraising event at the YWCA on October 17th from 12 p.m. to 3:30 p.m. The address is 6309 Martin Luther King. You can help Woman's Roots continue its work in helping women who have been released from prison. The group's motto is Healing the Woman from the Inside Out. Thank you. This is 90.1 Pacifica Radio. Find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. And now, instead of Barrett time, we have nothing.
I thought, no, we have a reprieve from fundraising. Because I really thought tonight was a fundraiser. I actually
Barrett's got excuses. He's got excuses.
I got lots of
he has no Barrett time.
I got a broken phone.
Hey, Barrett, what's your excuse?
A rumor on the street is.
I do want
on the street is crack.
I do want to state that this week Barrett does, in fact, not have a gigantic external keyboard.
Well, we can tell that when we
I got that working a little bit, yeah. But I still need a new laptop.
You got it working a little bit.
The Microsoft Surface stuff is coming out. I don't know if I want that, or you know, the MacBook Air is ever so slightly stale at this point.
Ever so slightly.
And then you've got the whole. Yeah, it's pretty stale. And then you've got the whole because it's so much encroaching on the MacBook Pro on the small one. It's like it's really hard to choose. So I'm
again
just
with the excuses.
Yeah, I'm just postponing
He's
making
got
a
excuses.
Decision.
You're gonna show up with like an
I need
XPS
one of everything.
15 one of these days.
I was looking at the Dell, the XPS 13, maybe that
They're
looked
nice.
Kind of sleek.
They're really nice.
They're tiny.
Man.
They're thin. They're metal. But yeah. It's just really hard. The frame and you know the aluminumness of the MacBook Air is just really nice. It's hard to get away from this form
factor.
Well,
the XPS 13 has actual for real carbon fiber.
Ooh.
Like
we shall
a
see.
Like a Lamborghini.
We shall see.
Like a little tiny Lamborghini. Except it's nowhere near as fast.
Yeah, and then I broke. Well, I didn't break my phone. This is the first time I actually didn't break my phone. The phone just kind of died on its own. I would assume through no doing of mine.
The phone became self-aware.
I realized
that it belonged to you and knew its fate was sealed.
I don't
want
to sit next to you anymore because you're going to infect my computer.
In the back of my mind, half of me is afraid that I bricked the phone because I was kicking around some text messages that would a while ago have bricked an Android phone, but I'm pretty sure my phone was packed. I really don't think that's it. Uh-huh. In the back, I'm like, that's a possibility.
Pwned.
That's a small possibility. I own myself.
Well, it's kind of funny. Whenever those kind of things show up, the string of text that crashes your browser or whatever, we send them to each other constantly.
Yeah. Hey, look at this.
Like as soon as somebody discovers it, like we'll drop it into the middle of the IRC server, and it was hilarious because you could tell anybody who was using with one of the last Mac text crash strings, yeah. Anybody who was using a Cocoa based IRC client versus an old Carbon one, and it was like disconnect, and like boom, 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 like right down the list. It was funny. Take humor and weird nerd things.
Yeah, so a new phone, and I'm having to sit here while it installs like 176 apps.
So what's your feelings on the curvy Samsung screen?
I'm kind of liking it. It's a little bit different. It's the edge, so it has like kind of a warped, maybe like 45 degrees on each side, and it doesn't look like it's glass glass bezel that's reflecting like a display. It looks like the display actually has a bit of a curve on the edges. So we'll see.
It
also looks like, you know, how, you know, when you drop a phone, as long as it doesn't hit on the glass edge, it's probably not going to break.
Mm-hmm.
This takes away that possibility. It's mostly glass on two sides. Yeah. We'll see how long this lasts.
What do they do with the, does the edge peak or whatever it is, does that work if you like swipe over from one edge? It's supposed to
show
your
contacts or
something?
There's some edge stuff there. It's also, this I guess apparently does like the thumbprint stuff for recognition. So it's got some perks in there. It also has no external memory, so no micro SD card.
It also has, I can see it has TouchWiz on it, so it's basically worthless.
No, what's TouchWiz?
That's Samsung's skin.
It's like CheeseWiz.
It's their Android skin. It's their terrible Android skin that terribles up everything they make.
Yeah, I don't like this. I like just pure Google. So we'll see how long it lasts. I'm going to run with this firmware for a little bit. And then, you know, if not,
come in next week and you're going to have Cyanogen on.
Yeah, that may happen. We'll see. It really depends on if I can still take advantage of if Cyanogen has anything that'll let me mess with
I have
the edges,
no idea.
So kind of
I don't know if they do or not. That, actually, I doubt since that's the new one, right?
Yes.
It's not going to be on the supported
not
list
yet. No.
Does Cyanogen, are they up to Lollipop yet? Do they support Lollipop and its flavors?
I don't know.
I don't remember. I know that like they do Kit Kat, and that was a big deal. I don't know if they have hit Lollipop or not.
They haven't put out much since April.
Oh, okay. So no.
So, yeah, CyanogenMod 11, 12 are the new ones.
CyanogenMod, for anyone curious about what we're babbling about, is an all-open-source replacement Android
ROM. Yeah.
ROM. Yeah, you put it on your phone if you're sick of Samsung or whomever. And
or all the bloatware. I mean, even my HTC phone, they just gave up the ghost. The what was it, the H19 or M18? Something like that.
Yeah.
There were a couple of things that you could not uninstall, and I really don't like that. Like, HTC had a couple of their apps and some kids games thing that always wanted to install on my phone, and you can't take it out. It's just, it's in there, and it reminds me of, you know, full circle back to 3.11 Windows. It's like that stuff that, you know, HP and people used to pack on their Gateway.
Yep.
Some of those old manufacturers. No
and
good.
So Cyanogen is one of, it's Cyanogen, like cyanogen.
Like the color.
Like the color. Or the... I don't know. I guess it's a chemical that kills you or something. But yeah, you can get it without all the AOSP stuff in it too, right? If you really want to go hardcore open source only, you can install the version of Cyanogen that has absolutely no Google services in it. And what you get when you do that, if I remember right from fiddling with it a year or two ago,
unfunctional phone.
You get like a phone that can make phone calls and can text and like send email and browse the web. And, like, that's it.
You can get other software on there, but you've got to sideload it, and it gets very difficult.
Yeah.
The main thing is that, you know, the Google Play services tie everything together. You're free of software that connects you to everyone else.
You can entertain your visions of being your own little miniature version of Richard Stallman.
Well, there's definitely a swing back to
except
where...
Richard Stallman wouldn't use Samsung phone.
The carriers are getting really bad about putting bloatware on the phones again. It seems to kind of, you know, flow and ebb, and we're definitely in, you know, a bloatware. The bloatware tide is coming in
I mean, it's bloatware just for the sake of bloatware.
It seems like HTC put out some, and so Samsung's like, we have to have our own, and, you know, then someone
and
else...
And it's all duplicative.
It overlaps, at least on the Android side, it overlaps apps that Google has already done. There's no need to have
and
that.
Done better,
yeah,
frankly.
Truly, yeah.
And it's just, but this time you can make sure you have the carrier and or OEM version of Maps, or the worst one is probably Samsung S Voice, which does absolutely nothing useful and duplicates the OK Google services. Just it does it badly. Just
eats up battery.
Eats up battery.
Processor.
Eats up your RAM.
Yeah, I like pure vanilla Android. This is not it.
Well, there should be new Nexus devices coming out, I guess, sometime
probably
soon.
Tomorrow, now that I spent
this up. Yeah, no doubt. Now that you spent
money
on that.
It's like washing my car. Washing a car, rather.
And I heard that there's going to be a... they're going to go back to there's going to be like a 5-inch form factor Nexus this time around instead of 6, which apparently everybody was really upset about, the lack of a 5-inch phone. 6 was too much, and they wanted 5.
I think if you can get the thinness down and, you know, like you've got a really small 5-inch phone, I think that would be kind of attractive, especially when you get into, you know, being able to have enough pixels and you with OLED and you're just a really, really nice pixel rates. You don't have to strain as much. You can see quite a bit more, you know. So I would carry a 5-inch phone just for weight and portability.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily like, you know, like the Note, whatever they're up to on that. That's slightly redonkulous. That's getting
it's like 6.4
on the large
or something,
side. Yeah. That's a very small tablet, is what that is.
Yes, yes, it is. Absolutely. What's your Pete? Are you daily drivering on the Android side at all yet, or are you sticking with iOS?
No, I'm pretty much doing iOS. For a long time I had a Nexus 7 tablet because the Mini, you know, the iPad Mini was not existing and was too expensive, but no, right now I've got an iPhone 6 Plus and an iPad Mini with LTE and a Mini 2, so which I put iOS 9 on it, and so you get the kind of pseudo multitasking thing.
Oh yeah, the slide over, what's this thing?
Yeah, which I found by accident using Flipboard. I go to flip the page over and suddenly it like opens up a thing where you can select another app.
Aha!
It's like, oh, okay, so I clicked it. Yeah, I clicked the map, and it's like, oh, so now I got both things on there at the same time.
Yeah,
then I slid it back over and I haven't done anything with it since.
It worked. Yeah, I put iOS 9 on my phone just like pretty much right before I left for the studio. It was downloading and it finished up right when I was ready to go out the door. And so far, the only thing I've noticed is that it has fixed the issue I was having with what was the with 8.4 or 8.0.4 or 8.1.4, whatever the immediate previous release of iOS 8 was. It fixed the problem I had where when I would listen to Bluetooth audio, the phone would get ridiculously hot and like start bleeding battery and like using enough energy to fry an egg. So that at least has been fixed, and that was my big problem, and I'm happy about that being gone. So thanks, Tim Cook. Much appreciated. Shout out from Houston.
They added a new screen.
Oh, they did? Oh, yeah, I don't use any of that. They added a new undeletable stupid app on the home screen.
They put a new undeletable app, but then I've got the search that can be swiped from. You'll notice that I have four dots.
Right.
And but one of them is that. Huh. I've never used that before.
I wonder if I have that, because you've got a 6.
Plus or
I
6.
Just have a 5S, so I've got a... Oh, well, it's...
Yeah, you do.
It's got this...
I used to get that pretty thing. Much from swiping down. Siri app suggestions, one of them is news, one of them is Starbucks.
Yes, I have already moved the news app into the crap folder. Where
the news
belongs.
Crap. For the I'm going to play folder. With it for a little while and see if I get any news, but I get all my news from Facebook and Twitter, so I don't know.
I selected some news items. I like Flipboard. I don't know if any of you have used that, but that's Flipboard. That's sort of my kind of magazine thing. I mean, obviously I get articles from Facebook and Twitter, but Flipboard will pull in. I don't do Facebook, but Twitter.
That's pretty.
What's that?
I only read my news.
All right, so on the iPhone, you can double tap the home button.
Okay.
And it brings up a list of your recently viewed apps, but now they're in this really cool
scrollable. Oh, yeah, they've changed the...
Yeah, they've changed...
Well, good, because it kind of was a little janky before.
Yeah, but so the way you access your recently opened apps now is prettier.
That's very fancy. Ooh, and you can sort of move them around.
What are you talking about?
All right, so
go back in the booth.
on the iPhone,
yeah.
You double tap the home button.
Right.
Get a list of your open apps.
Yeah.
And now they're these cool.
Ooh.
It's like, but you can still.
It's
you
the
can
same
still
thing. It's just they're sliding over the top of each other.
They're overlapping and they're sliding. You know.
Oh, and there's a neat little effect there. The one back is blurry.
Oh, Android's had that forever.
God, shut up.
Whatever.
Do you guys have copy paste yet?
Whatever. My wife just texted me and asked if I downloaded the app that makes your phone waterproof. So I have to go try that.
No, but if you can stick it in the microwave to extend your battery.
I heard that. Yeah, you can do a fast recharge if you put your phone in the mic. Don't actually. No one listening, don't actually do that. That's not a feature.
Now, has there been a thing that, the last two major iOS updates have had those hoaxes going by. The one about the update will make it waterproof.
The microwave one was called like Apple Wave or something like that. It was a big 4chan prank.
People are so wacky.
I actually ordered a 6S.
Did you?
Not because I'm excited about the 6S at all.
But because you're a consumer slave?
No.
Oh, okay.
Because this will prove that. Because my 16 gig iPhone 5 is getting a little long in the tooth.
Well, you know. Yeah, it is. 16 gigs is like really dragging it.
It's pretty horrible.
It's
which I actually had either 32 or 64 gig 4S.
Yeah.
But the 4S was getting to where it wasn't running the OS very well. So I bumped to a 5, but what I had access to was a 16 gig 5. And I was like, oh, it's not that big of a deal because, you know, I have everything in iTunes Match. And so I'll just keep everything in the cloud. But it's 16 gig is still annoying.
They did lower the price of cloud storage. I think you can get
there's a new iCloud tier
for
or something.
50 gig.
Yeah. But I use iTunes. The iTunes Match piece of it doesn't cost anything beyond the 25 or whatever a year for Match. So you can have a lot of music in Match. And so that's how I have, because I don't do a whole lot of video or pictures, but have a lot of music. So
I never turned that on. I refuse to play Apple's game.
Except for buying their stuff. That's their main game, and they've already got you.
Their hardware margins are really not that ridiculous.
You keep using that
anymore.
Word. I don't think it means
anything. No, their hardware margins aren't nearly as bad as you might think they are, and they're not making, they're making ridiculous money off of mobile and everything, but, I mean, you know, they want you for the services. They don't want you necessarily just for the hardware.
I thought it was they make, like, 60% of the profit or 80% of the profit in cell phones.
Yeah, I mean, on the mobile side, their margins are crazy. But as far as like the desktop hardware, the laptop hardware and all that, their margins aren't that much better than any other PC OEM. Although they are better. But it's not like they're not pulling in like a 50% margin on a laptop or whatever. Speaking of which,
well, maybe you've been thinking about holding off on going to iOS 9, even after hearing us talk about all the, you know, that'll give you superpowers and all that stuff. Here's a good reason to go ahead and put it in now. There is a security vulnerability that just broke. Apple was warned about it about a month ago, and they patched it. But apparently, he's demonstrated it. It allows someone to install malicious apps on iPhones and Macs via their Bluetooth-enabled AirDrop file sharing feature. Anyone in range of a target device with the feature enabled, that means, so there's the thing, you have to enable it if you're going to be vulnerable. But so if you have that on, so you turned it on to, you know, AirDrop a file to your computer or whatever, if you have that on, anyone can plant malware on your phone, even if you didn't tap accept for the offered file. It doesn't matter if they reject it or accept it. The vulnerability is already triggered by the time they can react to it, says Mark Dowd, Australian security researcher and consultant. Dowd's attack, which was first reported Wednesday morning by Forbes, takes advantage of not only the AirDrop bug in iOS, but also a vulnerability that allows corporations to install their own custom apps on Apple's otherwise tightly restricted operating system. Making use of that second bug, Dowd's attack can install an unapproved application on an iPhone that hasn't been jailbroken and even disable the pop-up prompt that asks if you want to trust the program's author. After gaining access, the attacker would then wait until your phone next rebooted and begin implanting malware. So this is rare for the iPhone. They've been pretty secure as such things go. It's this guy's figured that one out. One of the things he said, though, is that the things that make the iPhone secure, you know, it's architected so that individual apps have limited access to the user's data, though they can track location, for instance, or, you know, make in-app payments from the user's iTunes account. A full compromise of an iPhone would require exploiting a vulnerability in iOS's kernel, too, though Dowd points out that those deeper operating system bugs are frequently released by the jailbreaking community to help iPhone owners install unauthorized apps. So in other words, you've got this big community researching the kind of things to exploit it. Apple has released a security update for both the MacBook and iPhone attacks, and anyone with the most recent OS X Yosemite or iPhone 8.4.1 should upgrade to avoid the attack. Stubborn and MacBook owners who don't want to upgrade could alternatively disable AirDrop or their computer's Bluetooth feature altogether. But iPhone owners who don't install iOS 9 have no such easy fix. Since both Bluetooth and AirDrop can be toggled from an iPhone's lock screen, an attacker who gains physical access to a phone could still turn those features on and use them to plant malicious software even if the phone is locked. Basically, you need to disable AirDrop and also the ability to access Control Center from the phone's lock screen. So not great, but on the plus side, I mean, it's better than finding out about this exploit and there not being an update already ready for you to get. So, so you probably want to, remember, I guess, a few tips before you upgrade. Make sure and back up your device before you do your upgrade. And, you know, make sure you have some space free, because a lot of that's the biggest pain. You know, we were talking about 16 gig iOS devices. And if you've got it pretty close to full, it won't let you download the update. The easiest thing is if you have your phone paired with a machine, you know, with a desktop or laptop, if you hook it up to the machine and use iTunes to do it, that kind of handles all the stuff. It's really easy to back up stuff and then run the update. I ran it on my phone and on my iPad, and it went pretty quick and smooth. So it doesn't seem to have – I haven't heard any gotchas. It seems like you've got more risk of a gotcha if you don't do it than if you do, though. And speaking of bugs and gotchas, you know, the Apple Watch OS 2 was supposed to come out today. But shortly before they went to Gold – or the Gold Master, apparently, right after when they were getting the Gold Master, it revealed problems. There were bugs they found in the that are holding up the development process. It was supposed to come out today. They're delaying the launch because they, quote, discovered a bug in development of WatchOS 2 that is taking a bit longer to fix than we expected. Despite the Golden Master, or expected final version, having been released on September 9th, unspecified problems with the release are to blame for the delay. There's no revised release date for this update. Apple has only said that, quote, we will not release WatchOS 2 today, but will shortly. And they don't have any more information to share at this time. On the plus side, having the watches update on a different day as their, you know, first day than all the phones and iPads may end up being a little smoother because you won't be fighting with so many people. And then an interesting article, a sort of think piece from GigaOM. And I'd be interested to hear what the guys think on this as far as which way things may go, or maybe they'll go a third way. You know, the Surface is out there, and we've talked about it. And then they announced the iPad Pro, which has many Surface-like features to it, and clearly is aimed at kind of the same corporate environment as Microsoft Surface. This article by Nathaniel Mott, it says, is entitled "Why Enterprise Will Choose iPad Pro Over Microsoft's Surface." So, you know, basically sums the two up. And the part that's odd is some of the logic doesn't seem very good in this article. The thing he says is that, you know, the iPad Pro is a lot like Microsoft's Surface product. Both feature displays that seem just a little too large to be convenient. Both were designed with keyboard covers in mind, and both have gone to great lengths to convince people they should opt to spend money on a stylus. There is one important difference, though. The iPad Pro is an iPad, and Surface products are not. That's his main logic. I don't know. I like iPads and all that, but I don't know that that's really he does go on to you know, he says Apple isn't trying to sell a new product to the enterprise customers. It so obviously wants to attract with the iPad Pro. It's trying to sell them an iPad, which many of those potential customers probably use outside of work, that was built with them in mind. Microsoft tried to establish something new. Apple's expanding a popular product. I guess maybe. I think the better argument may be that there's a whole lot of people in the corporate world who are using iPhones, and so this is going to be if they're extending from the iPhone, that then the iPad Pro could then the iPad Pro would have, you know, bring your own device, and you're already using an iPhone, then this might, you know, the iPad Pro might make sense because it works like your other device that you're used to, which Microsoft played off of that for a long time with Windows, and you know, it worked for them for a while, but so it's just interesting to see how Apple and Microsoft have kind of switched sides on this, where Microsoft seems to be trying to be more revolutionary than Apple. Well,
Lee wanted to chime in.
You wanted an opinion, just real quick. The the profusion of Apple devices, iPads and iPhones in the enterprise is an interesting, like, it's charted an interesting path because it's a bottom up movement. Instead of being something that often is dictated by IT down, like a top down kind of move, you see Apple products invading the enterprise bottom up because employees brought them in and wanted to use them. And at some point at a lot of companies, a C-suite or a VP showed up with an iPhone or an iPad and said, I like this. I want to use this. IT, make this happen. If you give an IT department its druthers, 99 times out of 100, they're going to want to implement the Microsoft solution, because Microsoft's made it very easy with things like the Surface to integrate it into your Active Directory
80
setup.
Times out of 100.
Well, right.
Unix shops out there.
And by very easy, there you mean hiring some consultants who know how to do it.
No, well, I mean, okay, so let me rephrase.
Because let's say you want Exchange, right?
You want Exchange,
now you need AD, and now you need, I forgot what, you need like five things if you want Exchange.
You're already running Active Directory. If your most shops... Unless you're, you know, a Linux web hosting company or whatever, if you're most Fortune 500 companies, you're running Active Directory. Excuse me. And the most school districts, you're running Active Directory, especially large school districts. It's relatively easy to integrate a Microsoft Surface solution instead of an iPad solution if you've already got Active Directory on the ground. But what you see instead in a lot of these places is the BYOD movement, which I think we can, I know it's contentious
bring
to
say. Bring your own device,
BYOD, which it's kind of contentious to say it, but you can chart that back to Apple's influence. You can chart that back to people wanting to bring iPhones in when corporate mandated devices were generally BlackBerries at the time. So I think this article, I was kind of skimming it while you were talking, Pete, and I think this article, like you said, has multiple logical flaws in it. I don't think enterprises will choose iPad Pro over Surface. I think in a lot of cases, the C-suites, VPs, and employees will force iPads into businesses, especially on the Fortune 500 side, and changes will be made to accommodate it. But I think if you give the IT department its choice, they're going to implement... Either a Microsoft-based solution, be it a Surface or like an XPS tablet or something, or they'll go with a Unix-type device if it's a Unix shop. I think iPad, from a IT management perspective, is dead last in just about any area.
Well, except for healthcare, I will say that, you know, for the most part. The iOS solution. What happens is right now we're in a place with the BYOD where people think or feel like if they're bringing an iPad into play. Now this doesn't account for the execs and so forth.
No, it never does.
But for the general boots on the ground user, boots in the hard drive kind of user, boot to the head user, they may have a predilection towards wanting to use an iPhone or using a Mac. And if you set the expectation that says, look, you know, this is not completely supported in our environment, we can't necessarily guarantee it's going to work with everything, then they kind of feel, and it's weird, they kind of feel empowered to like figure it out.
Yeah.
It's like, say, okay, I realize this isn't going to work. And sometimes you just don't hear from them because they know better than to call.
Right.
And they actually kind of end up solving their own problems. There is a lot to be said for the way that the iPhone will connect to ActiveSync and Exchange.
Yes.
It does it very well. When it comes to setting up a phone, like when I have a user that wants to get their mobile connected to their email, I'd rather have them do it on an iPhone because it's bing, bang, boom. It's easy.
You could just push an ActiveSync profile out.
Right. But with the Android, it really depends on which version. And we've run into a handful of problems with Lollipop 5.0 wasn't completely compatible, working right with ActiveSync. And so you say, well, you need 5.1. And so we're like, how do I get it? Well, that's up to your carrier, whether or not you're going to be allowed to have it or they're going to push it out to you. So there are a lot of challenges, I think, with the Android devices. But we're in a real, real strange place right now because...
Do you support BlackBerries at all still?
We do support them, but there's just not that many people buying them. There's just not... We took down our last Bez...
I was going to say, do you still have a Bez server?
We have one in the UK, but we took down the ones that we have in the United States and pushed all the existing BlackBerry users to ActiveSync, which is not a beautiful solution for BlackBerry.
No. Well, it doesn't do the stuff that made BlackBerry famous in the first place.
Right. But everybody, I mean, you know, because users are vain and conceited, they're really falling into either iPhone or Android camps pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. BlackBerry is kind of
It's older kind of.
It's old people technology.
It's sales guy technology at EMC and Symantec. Older sales when I was there, a lot of guys still. No, a lot of the younger guys still were using it too because the physical keyboard.
Yeah, but you know what happened to the guy, Mr. Robot, that had a BlackBerry?
Yes, I do now because now I'm watching it.
Oh yeah? Are you caught up or where?
No,
are you?
No. Me and Laura are on. I think we just watched episode 4 or 5 yesterday.
Yeah, but what?
I mean, you know, I'd rather have somebody bring an Apple or an iMac or an iPhone or an iPad to work. What we're struggling with right now is we're going through a really, really gritty email integration. So we're taking a lot of people. We have 3 Active Directory Exchange environments and 1 GroupWise.
Well, but it sounds like group wise. Oh my God!
Well,
hold on.
No Lotus Notes in there.
So we have
Domino.
Well, we started off. We were going to push everybody into group wise. So we started this.
Why?
We started this march towards like.
Why would you do that?
Because we sell the product.
Oh.
Okay. Oops. Okay. So. It was an in-house free eat your own dog food solution, right? So we started the march. Some might call it a death march towards group wise.
That's like the old Roy version of dog food. It's not like even kibbles and bits.
So then we started the march. So we got acquired by an Active Directory company, an exchange company. So now we've reversed that march and going back towards exchange.
Buddy, turn around.
But so it's been weird because we've, you know, for the people that were Exchange and Active Directory users, introducing them to GroupWise was we got the expected amount of blowback on that from people that were like, I can't use this.
Yeah, well,
But so when we made the decision to go back to Exchange, I was completely unprepared for the response of people that are very pro GroupWise. There are some people, I mean, if you're raised in that environment,
right,
and or if you're a participant in creating that environment, people are attached to it. And they look at, they have a, again, this goes back to what I'm talking about, where people have kind of predilections. They say, you know, they're kind of snooty about their technology. If they're a fan of one, they're anti the other. So GroupWise is the anti, or Outlook is the anti GroupWise. So we've got people now we're trying to, so one of the things we're struggling with is we also own SUS. So we have a lot of SUS Unix, Linux users out there.
SUSE.
I call it Seuss just to make them mad.
Dr. Seuss.
Well, at any rate, we have a lot of these Linux, these quote-unquote Linux users.
Yeah, pretty much.
With their animated GIFs.
Linux.
My name is Tarvo Linux.
Linux.
So at any rate, so what we're having fun with now, and see, this is why I'd rather see an iPad or an iPhone or even a Mac computer, is I've got people trying to, because you can get Office for the Mac at least, but connecting Thunderbird to Exchange on Linux has always been,
just so you know.
But there's like, you know, you're making me migrate to Exchange, you support me now. And it's like, oh my God.
Well, I mean, at least it sounds like that you guys have kind of crossed the Rubicon to at least allow the possibility of other devices, because there's plenty of companies where if you walk into your desk with your Mac under your arm, about 3 seconds after you sit it down, like 4 guys from IT security show up and they're like, what do you think you're doing with that?
Yeah, that's a nice Mac.
Yeah. You can come collect this at the end of the day.
But I will say, you know, my conversion to the Mac has saved my butt because I've been able to support these users since we have allowed that into the environment. I think the biggest challenge, and one of the things, you know, that you see in any IT department is you get your IT people, they know certain systems. They know Exchange, they know Active Directory, they know Windows.
And oddly enough, no matter how much corporate training you get, a lot of that is like what you get brought in knowing.
Yeah. But but people that understand, you know, I don't even understand Linux that much, but people who understand Linux, people understand a Mac OS, are limited. So when somebody does need help, there's some poor sucker, and that's usually me, that, you know, has to turn around and support that. But I'm glad, because I like knowing things and I like knowing how to do stuff. So at least from my standpoint, I don't mind it so much. But you take your average service desk, help desk at a company, and you say, okay, support eDirectory, Active Directory, Exchange, GroupWise, Mac, Linux, all of that. And here's the phone, answer it, solve problems. That's your job. It's like their head's going to explode.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No, it's a bomb.
Yeah. I'm going to make a clock. I'm going to show you all.
Make that clock in Linux.
Is it time to go Windows 10 yet?
No.
Has anyone taken the plunge?
I'm running on my gaming PC.
I've seen it, and I've had a chance to interact with it, and there are a couple of tweaks that they did in 10 that I just adore. Like, you can click the start button and search.
That's how it should be. They've restored functionality
yes,
from
they've
7
restored.
and 8.
Instead of having to swipe, figure out how to, like when you're remote controlling someone's computer and you're trying to swipe.
Right.
God, that's just a pain.
I'm using it on my gaming PC for just to have something to game with.
I've heard for the most part, like a lot of the deployment servers have slowed, they're no longer laggy and loaded. So, you know, you can have a good chance of going out there. You can get past, you know, all the authentication stuff like that. But now I'm just wondering, like, you know, is the software mature enough? And I'm thinking,
I mean, what do you want to do?
Not have to mess around with it and not lose any downtime, you know, moving from one Windows installation to the other.
What would you be coming from?
Windows 8.
XP?
8.
If you're coming from 8,
it's a
step
upgrade.
Up.
Yeah.
It's a logical and intelligent upgrade from 8.
I tell you what, though.
You have to have a touchscreen?
I think they missed... You don't need a touchscreen. I think they missed the opportunity to go...
To 9.
To go 9. Yes, they did miss that.
I can't wait for Windows 11.
They missed the opportunity to go full Metro or full modern or whatever we're supposed to call it and abandon the desktop. That was... Windows 8 wasn't a train wreck because it had the modern interface. It was a train wreck because it had both. And because you had to context switch yourself back between them depending upon what you wanted to do. And some things you could do in both places. And one way was worse than the other. If they had simply abandoned the entire desktop metaphor and gone to a big, fancy, tile-based interface with animated tiles and kind of doubled down on it and made their way to be, you know, multitasking inside that interface, I think it would have been great. I think they really missed out on doing that. And instead, you got this broken desktop and a useless tile interface where, like, you don't have to use either one and they're both terrible. 10 rectifies some of that, but, I mean, still, I really wish they had simply stuck with one or the other rather than trying to sort of ease the transition and just screw it up. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like it's an also-ran. It's unfortunate. Yeah. There's not any real true major breakthroughs that make you super excited to see it.
Yeah, use my Mac.
It's like, how am I going to make this work like what I'm used to?
Yeah, okay. It sounds like just wait for a little while.
I don't know if there's any point in waiting.
Seven.
I think
if you're on 8, there's no point in waiting.
If you're on 7, you need to go now.
Yeah.
Go now, so you can learn it because it's not going to get it's going to be so different in further incarnations of the operating system.
Yeah.
One of the biggest struggles that I've seen, you know, in my role as the helpline columnist for the Eastern Chronicle, a lot of my readers, computer users, are senior citizens, and they've been nursemaiding Windows XP computers all the way up to today. I mean, they still have XP computers. So when you went from XP to Windows 8, that was jarring. That was so radically different than what you were used to and how to interface with a computer.
I lived through Ubuntu Unity. That was pretty ugly.
I'm trying to imagine.
Still ditch Unity whenever I can.
But that's what I've seen is people struggling. So Windows 7 to Windows 8, it's clunky, but you at least kind of have a sense of it. But the whole tiles and all of that interaction is just ridiculous. And I hate Windows 8 myself. I've not enjoyed it at all. Windows 10 at least gives me hope for the future of having a Windows computer, if that should come up. I mean, I have one.
They might get it in check by Windows 12.
I need a couple of things in a Windows computer to make it usable for me, and that's easy access to my applications.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that I've always accessed my applications, I have them down there and, you know, pinned to the start menu and pinned to the taskbar and on the desktop. And sometimes with, and like being able to get into the control panel and being able to, you know, configure mail and stuff like that, it's not super intuitive.
Yeah, Windows 8 just dumps that over completely. 10 restores a lot of that, yeah, but 8 took it away.
Well, the nice thing is, and once I got used to it, and what I really like about 10 is you click start and you get the search menu. So I can type in the name of the application that I want. I can type in control panel, get it. I can type in Windows Update, get it. I can get there. And I don't feel like I'm struggling as much with it. But,
yeah. You know. I don't know. Some people like it. We've all switched to Macs up here at Technology Bytes.
You know, I just want it to be easy to use. And I'm getting old, too. Once I figure something out, I don't want to have to... I mean, I like learning new stuff on my terms, but not, like, when I need to be productive.
Well, Jay, install OS 20.
Yeah.
You're so 2020.
I would come back from the future and prevent myself from upgrading to Windows.
And, I mean, I've got... At home, it's there's no... There's no one operating system to rule them all. And maybe there was back when XP was new or when Windows, you know, when Windows 98 was the bomb. But
Open
I mean,
BSD.
I have to, nope, not even then, because I have to
now.
Run. Nope. I have to run Windows at home to play the games that I want to play, or I have to boot camp my Mac into Windows. I run OS 10 because that's the operating system I prefer to do my work in, and then I've got a closet full of Linux servers because that's what I have to use to do anything productive.
Closet real. Linux user, real. Got it.
Yeah, do anything. Well, because I run Bind9 and I run ISCDHCPD.
Ooh, Bind9! I saw that in the show that we like.
Yeah,
Mr. Robot.
And Nginx, because there's absolutely no Windows web server that's worth. Anything.
No, and that's why would you ever want a WAMP stack? Why? I mean, that's the thing. It's like every time I look
WAMP
at a Windows
stack.
Server or like, you know, like how many, you know, users you can actually stack on like an AD server, it's just the numbers are so low or like how often you have to reboot a Windows server every decade. Oh my.
It gets complicated. And I mean, I know people have, there's defenders of IIS and good for them, but IIS is terrible. And if you have to live with it, then I feel
to me, the interface to work with IIS, the management is interface is pretty bad. Like trying to figure out where stuff is if you don't do that a lot.
With Nginx, you can do the config files with your own curly brace indentation style. So, which I guess is a whole other like potential area of ridiculous complexity that would drive people off.
No, but anything that's text-based where you can see the configuration, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of what the Unix philosophy kind of is. That's where it's going. Now, one saving grace for PHP users and for people running WAMP stacks is I believe PHP 7 comes with its own, more or less, its own web server. It's not like a full-blown web server, but you're not going to need, you know, Nginx, you're not going to need Apache, you're not going to need IIS to sit behind the PHP installation.
Not going to use their...
Although most people, if you're on Windows, you're probably doing.
Was it Nginx secretly Speed Racer's brother?
Yes.
I think that's you're good, man. Yeah.
No, that was Racer X.
Same thing.
Racer
had an engine in his car.
He did.
Yes.
He did.
I think that was Nginx. Was, so Nginx
oh,
was the motor.
Second cousin of.
No,
Racer
Nginx
X.
Was the motor of Racer Speed X. Racer's secret brother.
So okay. Racer's X engine was.
I need to go back and rewatch that. It's been I haven't seen that since I was like 10.
It's on. I think it's on Hulu.
The cartoon.
I would say
they have the old. Cartoon. They have all the movies, old. Yeah. They have a lot of the old 70s.
Candy.
I would
they
say
have Racer. They have Ultraman. They have Johnny Sacco.
Save your childhood and don't go watch it again.
Okay. So I'm preserving it. Remember it being really cool. I can't believe this is on.
I think the memory of it will serve you much better.
I believe so.
Experience than I would imagine.
Oh,
the mammoth car.
Yeah. There's a lot of that.
Although at Comic Palooza there Trixie. Was a really
Speed.
Nice.
You got a nice shot of that too.
Yeah, you did.
There was a great mock up of the Mach 5. A mock up. I get it now.
But
when you opened up the Easter egg on that thing,
Spritel and Chim Chim were in the back.
Up, you opened up the trunk and Spritel and Chim Chim are painted on the trunk lid.
Why do I know that?
Candy,
Trixie.
Andy.
So if you,
Lee, Speed.
Lee, if you were to rewatch,
and it was like the same three actors doing all the voices.
Oh, come on. That was because was it ever done? Was it done in Japanese originally, or was it done in English?
Yeah,
it was,
I believe I might be off.
They had to have the dialogue.
I think it was the original Japanese cartoon that they dubbed. Yeah. But we should go look that up. But I believe that's how it went.
What were you going to say, Barrett? I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just wondering, like, if you were to rewatch it now, would it destroy the magic of Speed Racer from 2 weeks ago for you?
There was no magic of Speed Racer ever. I watched the movie recently because I saw that it was on Netflix or something, and I was like, you know, why not? I'm just going to watch this. And it is like, it is the most color-saturated, blow your eyes out through the back of your head. I mean, it's incredibly loud.
Lee was more of a wacky racist kind of guy.
did the movie? So I remember I never watched the Speed Racer movie, but I was in a store, like a electronics store, and they were showing it on the TVs.
Yeah.
And I couldn't tell from the, I mean, it looked super saturated, like the colors were crazy.
It was.
But then the other thing was, and I couldn't tell if this was because they had all the TVs set to the like
ultra bright
motion correction or whatever. Or if the movie was done that way, but it was every one of the TVs, like everything was like looked fake. It was like real.
I think it was stylized. It was a little
oversaturated.
Well,
I mean, they didn't film it in 48 FPS or anything like that. But if you do have a TV that does the 120 hertz or whatever, and you turn that on, it probably like would add to the feeling of a movie.
All right, so it's Maha Speed Racer was originally Maha Go Go Go, which translates loosely to Mach Go Go Go, and they said, okay, we got to call it Speed Racer. Yeah, originally done. Tatsuo Yoshida is the guy that did it.
Yoshida!
Yoshida!
Oh!
Candy!
Oh, speaking of weird Japanese anime and American cartoons and stuff, if you want to have a really interesting mashup cartoon experience, do a Google search on Bart Kira.
Wow.
It's amazing. Some amazing stuff. And there's a couple of websites that it's a mashup of Akira and The Simpsons. And it is.
Is it a full blown movie? Because I'm seeing the trailer
made,
for
made
it.
They've made a very long trailer. I don't think they've actually made the movie yet. Okay. It's been completely done by, it's kind of like fan fiction. But there's some great still art from it. And there's a really great video clip from it. It's if you like Akira and you like The Simpsons, it's a great mashup.
Is it all like, Tetsuo, don't have a cow, man?
Have we had much of a chance to get into The Martian?
No, we haven't.
We
have a few minutes left.
We I know that we have the Try Buyer Fry.
Sorry for derailing, Pete.
Well,
no, I mean,
let's talk about the Martian because
it's been kind of a TV movie episode.
It has. So I know that I know that Lee has had kind of an immersive Martian experience this week
off this planet.
I've seen the movie twice at this point. I was in Toronto over the weekend at the premiere reporting on it. And I got to meet all of the cast. Met Andy Weir, the author of the book.
Matt Damon.
Met Matt Damon.
Mr. Bean.
Met Sean Bean.
Oh, you got it. I thought Rowan Atkinson was going to be in it.
No. It was actually Sean Bean. I met Jessica Chastain and Kate Mara. I also went to the Houston premiere yesterday, and Mackenzie Davis and Sebastian Stan were there. Along with some more Fox people and a bunch of astronauts and stuff, and that was cool. But it was neat. It was a great event. I got to attend the red carpet gala premiere thing. I was severely underdressed for it.
By gala, you mean like black tie?
Yes, black tie gala that I showed up to wearing
khaki shorts. Business
casual. Would be
the best part was, since you'd seen the premiere before the Houston one, you could shout out helpful tips to him before he figured it out.
Yeah, I was
on screen.
Hey, why don't you try cracking hydrazine to release the oxygen and turn it into water?
So, do you think it's worth seeing? Is it?
It
like,
is.
Is it
is
a good ride of a
is
film?
It, is, it, the, is it the Tom Hanks Apollo 13 of Mars missions?
Yes. it's a very good movie. The screenwriter, a fellow named Drew Goddard, who I got to meet, along with Ridley Scott. So
not of the space. Center,
my
right?
My Kevin.
I was
going to
say he
number,
had a good name for working on a space film.
My Kevin Bacon number has been reduced basically to two at this point, since I've not
two
met
degrees
all these
away
famous
from Bacon.
People. I'm not 2 degrees away from Bacon. If Kevin Bacon had actually been there, then it would have been one.
Yeah,
but,
1 degree.
But he wasn't. He wasn't there.
You give him a hug. It's,
I could have touched him and then gotten like a 0.5. No, but
we are
so,
so
it
close
is
right
a.
Yeah.
You
would have had
Bacon.
To blow to 0.5 to get the courage up.
I'm on ground bacon.
So the movie, if you've read the book, you know the book is this is The Martian by Andy Weir. It tells the story of an astronaut named Mark Watney who is marooned on Mars when the mission when the mission that he's on, they have to abort. There's a big storm, and so the landing mission where he's one of the crew members has to take off without him, basically. And
lonely astronaut.
He is.
I know nothing
about
this.
Robinson Crusoe on Mars.
That's the setting.
Space nuts.
I said far out space nuts. Launch. And so the plot of the movie basically is this guy has to survive on Mars until he can be rescued, and because of the vagaries of orbital mechanics, help is like 4 years away. Because the crew that left can't turn around, and the next mission in the Ares program, the fictional Mars Ares program, is like three or four years
Johnny
away.
Five, the cute Martian rover, is
sadly, there is no cute, well, sadly, there's no cute Martian rover. Uh-huh. There's no cute robots or kids in the movie. A lot of the film is the astronaut Mark Watney is played by Matt Damon, and a lot of the movie and a lot of the book also is him by himself contemplating loneliness and how to survive. There's lots of challenges. There's engineering challenges. How do you grow food? How do you, you know, not die? How do you keep the habitat that he's in? How do you maintain it? And how do you make sure that you've got all the supplies and everything you need? And the author, Andy Weir, when he was putting the book together, originally serially published it on his own little web forum and had no contacts with NASA or JPL and did all the research himself. And then turned out that he did all of it very, very, very accurately, because after the book was published and it took off very rapidly, got New York Times bestseller on hardback and then also on the paperback. Of course, after the book was published and got popular, he got a lot of NASA contacts, and he got a lot of praise for having gotten his science accurate. And the book is very science heavy, but not in a equation boring kind of way. It's a very engaging story with an extremely warm, humorous narrator who makes the process of walking through what he's doing on Mars and how he's surviving really, really engaging. It's funny. It's well told, and the movie works really, really well. And the best part about the movie is they didn't dumb out the science. It is still a very technical but engaging movie.
Did you see it on a large screen? Like, is it on an IMAX?
In the Toronto premiere, it was a large screen, but it was an enormous theater, and we were way, like, the press was in
Canadian and in English subtitles?
No, it was in. Well, everybody's heads were flappy because it was in Canada. And then here in
Terrence,
but when you do that in your spacesuit, it's terrible. And then here, the Houston premiere was at the Cinemark down in Webster.
Subtitled in English?
That was subtitled in English, and that was on a pretty big screen. Both were in 3D. I would not recommend seeing it in 3D. It's post-processed 3D.
It's not. I don't like that.
Ridley Scott doesn't shoot in 3D. Very few, like, the filmmakers prefer it because the cameras apparently are so awkward and they have to be huge and whatever.
Well, I can't wait for Avatar 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Yeah, well, they'll be pre-rendered in 3D for your convenience.
4D or 5D, or I want Smell-O-Vision.
So, yes, go see The Martian.
Or him not to make any more movies.
Smells blue.
Go see The Martian. It's a great movie. It's not out yet. It'll be out, I don't know, a couple weeks or something.
I think it's like the first Friday in October.
That's why we canceled the Geek Gathering.
Yeah, I think it's on the 2nd. That's not right. That's a Monday. Maybe it's on Friday the 30th.
Yeah, but it's on that first.
It's got to be either Friday the 30th or October 6th, one of the two. Anyway,
the first Saturday after the first Friday
of the equinox. And go see it. It's a great movie. If you like space, if you like science, if you like not being pandered to by dumbed down entertainment, it's a very entertaining movie that does not treat you like an idiot. So that's my recommendation.
So you're saying this is the best movie of its type since Biodome?
Biodome's a masterpiece, man. Don't knock Pauly Shore.
Weasel.
I would say that it has a very distinct possibility of being even better than Biodome. Unless you just really loved Biodome.
Don't let the weasel hear you say that.
He's wheezing the juice, man.
All right, let's see here.
October 2nd is when it comes out. It was originally released to Yeah, it was originally supposed to not hit until the 25th of November, but they bumped it up so it wouldn't compete with other films.
Why would they release it on a Monday? That didn't make any sense. Well, whatever. I'm not a
Martian days are shorter.
That makes sense. That's correct. Actually, they're...
Monday's Friday in Mars.
No. It's Mars. Hold on.
I think they're longer. I think they're longer.
It's Monday on Mars. It's actually Friday.
Well, the years would be longer.
It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
The
Martian day is called a sol. I know that. And let's see real quick here.
Did you learn that from the movie?
I knew that before, but they do talk about that in
You brushed up on your Martian.
No, a Martian soul, it's pretty much ours. Ours is like about 24 hours and maybe 11 minutes. Martian day is 24 hours, 39 minutes. Because it's not like so much how large the orbit is, it's how fast it's
depends on whether you're measuring that with a government-sanctioned clock or a clock you
so I measure it in megabytes, not megabytes.
Is that in metric or English units?
I measure in mibibibibytes, whatever the,
capital
the
M, capital
broken
B.
SI units are.
All right, well, we got a few minutes left. Let's see if we can knock out a few...
In the world of technology, new things come out every day. Our judges will decide whether to try, buy, or fry.
Sizzle.
Okay, well, here's a quick one. There's I wondered just kind of where people come down on this one. Robot ethicists have launched the campaign against sex robots, seeking a ban on the development of robotic sexy time.
Isn't this what we've been like angling for the entire time we've been making technology?
Well, doesn't pornography and the sex trade drive technology? I mean, CD-ROMs held the most porn. Now the internet has it all.
Yeah.
And wouldn't this be like the ultimate? It's the combination of try, buy, and fry.
I see what.
Although
they
probably
there.
Want you to buy then try, not try then
buy. No returns. Well, okay. Slightly sex robot.
I read the article.
What's the article say?
It's really the reality of pleasure bots is fast approaching. Mechanical toys for sexual pleasure already exist, of course, but adding AI. A company called True Companion claims to be producing the world's first sex robot, Roxy,
with
of course, way too many X's in it, this year. Despite questions of technical readiness and ethics, Roxy, priced at $7,000, has thousands of pre-orders.
Only $7,000?
I don't know how you ban. It's one of these things where you kind of go, I can see where the ethicists have their question, but I don't see how they're going to succeed in banning such a thing.
Now, I am going to buy a big stack of the Campaign Against Sex Robot stickers. These are pretty awesome. I think I need one of these on
every vehicle I have. They've got like a droid with a Ghostbusters no sign over it.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Who are you going to call? Oh, there's the music. All right, so don't have sex with robots. That's our parting message.
Oh,
tip of the day. Tip of the day.
I think it really
and
is.
And install iOS 9 if you've got an iOS device. There's our kind of. And see the Martian. And what else did we learn tonight?
That was it.
Go ahead and upgrade.
Run Windows 10.
Yeah.
Go to geekradio.com and buy a shirt, or else get ready and pledge through the tip jar this next week, because it's a pledge drive coming up.
That's right, pledge drive coming up.
Put your electronics in a trash can.
Faraday cage.
Oh, a metal trash can.
All right, well, go to our website, learn about the upcoming party, too, because we would like to see you at our 20th anniversary party.
DJ Fail.
DJ Fail will be there, yes. All right.
Wiki.
Wiki. All right, this has been another episode of Technology Bites in the Can. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barry.
I'm Lee.
And he's...
Rufus.
What?
Yeah, the whole time.
Group us.
The Walk for Mental Health Houston is a community-based event to raise awareness and funding for Harris County nonprofit agencies and programs that provide mental health services. This year, the walk will be at Stude Park on October 10th. On-site registration begins at 7 a.m. and the walk starts at 8 a.m. There'll be a mental health expo with door prizes at 9:30, and the event should be over by 11 a.m. If you or your friends would like to organize a team for the walk, please contact Patrick McIlvain at 713-705-7058 or visit thehoustonwalk.org for more information. This is 90.1 Pacifica Radio. Find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at KPFT Houston.
KPFT has a fun drive coming up, and we need your help to make it a success. Our phone volunteer trainings are coming up, and we could really use your help. You'll meet KPFT listeners just like you and help this community radio station. Your efforts make a difference and can make this a fun, fast, and successful drive. We hold phone volunteer training regularly to accommodate all kinds of schedules. Visit kpft.org for a complete list of training dates. If you are a seasoned phone volunteer, call 713-526-4000 to sign up for a volunteer shift. You're tuned into Pacifica Radio, kpft.org, twitter.com/kpft, facebook.com/kpft Houston.